It has been another rocky week in Washington. We'll take a look at the latest on Donald Trump, James Comey, and how our congressional delegation is reacting to it all. In Madison, there's another new plan for paying for roads and highways. We'll give you our, well, 2 cents on the matter and take a bigger look at where the state budget stands. The Bradley Foundation may be the quiet partner in conservative politics, but hacked records show where it's spending its money. A hint, the State House may be more important than the White House. And this week, the city moved to avoid 2 court dates, okaying a downtown strip club, which avoids a lawsuit, and settling a lawsuit with the family of Dontre Hamilton, the man killed by a former police officer in Red Arrow Park. All of that, plus winners, losers, and viewer questions from the state's best political team today on JS on Politics. Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and we'll begin today, as we so often do because of all the news in Washington, with this segment on All the News in Washington. We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, to talk about the twists and turns and ups and downs and wiggles and waggles in Washington this week. This is not an episode of Scandal we're talking about. We're talking about the Trump White House and the James Comey situation, who was fired earlier this week by Donald Trump. Craig, can you give us a sense of all this? There's so much back and forth here. How does Donald Trump come off in this scenario where he's firing the person who's leading an investigation into his campaign and the Russian ties and so forth?
Not well, I don't think. I mean, it's more of a sense. I mean, it's sort of a growing and ongoing and growing sense of kind of chaos here in Washington. And the Republican Party has not, you know, is sticking by. The members of Congress are largely sticking by Donald Trump. But obviously, it's created an uproar here. I think if you look at there's more polling out this morning by Quinnipiac about Trump's numbers, which, if anything, have gotten a little bit worse. And this episode, I think, tends to kind of reinforce the soft spots in his public perceptions, which go to temperament and trustworthiness. The public sort of perceives him as a strong man, which this may reinforce, but it also has big reservations about his temperament and about his evenness and judgment and honesty. And so the questions surrounding the firing of Comey when they involve the investigation of Trump's campaign and the president himself to some degree, I think, tend to reinforce that. So I don't think this is going to help the president's public standing. And in some ways, I think it creates some uncertainty even about his standing with Republicans in Congress, even though they aren't breaking with him. There's huge concerns among Republican lawmakers about their own agenda and passing an agenda in this environment.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for them, certainly any distraction like this doesn't help. But let's talk just very briefly on, I mean, Democrats are saying that a special prosecutor is warranted here. How, for our viewers, how does a special prosecutor on a practical basis differ from what the FBI is doing?
Well, it just creates a different sort of power base for an investigation that is one more step removed, even though the FBI is supposed to be investigating independently from the president. As we've just seen, the director of the FBI serves at the pleasure of the president. A special prosecutor would be one more step, I think, one more would be at more arm's length from the president, creates more independence. These special prosecutors, special investigations tend to have a momentum of their own. And so I think the reason why presidents are reluctant to go there is because they know that they can't predict what's going to happen at the end of that path.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about Paul Ryan and the other members of our delegation here in Wisconsin. Paul Ryan, for instance, has resisted the call for a special prosecutor, saying that, you know, that's not warranted yet. But how do you think they're reacting and to this issue this week, and how are they positioning themselves with the voters here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, there's only one Republican member of Congress from Wisconsin that I'm aware of right now that it's sort of expressed concerns about the firing. That's freshman Republican Mike Gallagher of Green Bay. He's called the timing suspicious. He says he has concerns about it and questions about it. That's further than his other colleagues from the state on the Republican side of the aisle have gone. And Paul Ryan, as you noted, came out last night after some initial silence and stood behind the president's decision. So it's another case where sort of the Republican leadership in particular has been faced with a choice of whether to back up the president or break with the president on a big issue like this. And they've chosen to stick with him. What that means for them down the road, or what it means for their agenda, remains to be seen. But there is a lot of concern among Republicans about what this situation is going to do to an already huge lift, which is getting a health care bill passed in the Senate and then getting the House and the Senate to agree on that, much less on really thorny issues like tax reform.
All right. And finally, let's shift a little bit to a former member of Congress who was in the news this week, Mark Green, who spent many years in Congress and successfully ran for governor a few cycles back. But he was appointed by Donald Trump to a position for the U.S. Aid for International Development. Talk a little bit about Mark and his background, because he has a lot of ties in Africa and in foreign service.
Yeah, after he left Congress, he actually served as ambassador to Tanzania. He also has had a succession of jobs in this field, which is international development, international aid. You know, he's worked with agencies that have worked on controlling tropical diseases. A lot of this work is taking place in Africa, where a lot of these programs are. So in many ways, you know, it was kind of a logical appointment for Mark Green, who in fact is the child of two parents from other countries, England and South Africa. So Mark Green, who served with Paul Ryan, in fact, was elected to Congress with Paul Ryan. I don't anticipate having any difficulty being supportive for this job. He's got good relations on both sides of the aisle. And again, this is an area where he's got a lot of expertise.
Yeah, is this just another example of that? I mean, certainly these Wisconsin ties we're seeing at various, you know, layers and levels in the government. I mean, I assume being familiar with Ryan's Priebus and folks like that wouldn't hurt in terms of getting his name in front of Donald Trump.
Yeah, and of course this is a job, a different kind of job, and from those other folks you're talking about, in that it's you know, it's a job that it requires a particular expertise, and in this case, Mark Green has it.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. We'll be back, I'm sure, next week after we see what happens and transpires in Washington. Thanks, Craig.
All right.
We're joined now by Mary Spicuzzo in the studio and Jason Stein from our Madison Bureau. And guys, I just wanted to get your quick take on the Comey situation in Washington. What's your takeaway from how this is all falling out this week, Mary?
You know, Trump supporters have said he's been frustrated with Comey for some time and that this was happening for a while. Other people really question the timing, obviously, given the investigation into his campaign's ties to Russia. I think anytime your press secretary, Sean Spicer, has to hide, I guess it wasn't in the bushes, but near the bushes, trying to avoid having to take questions from media, that's probably a bad sign. And I think there's going to be more fallout continuing than they expected.
Yeah, and Jason, what in particular are you watching about all of this? I mean, it's interesting as sort of the political theater aspect of it, but there's some real consequences here, too, in terms of what happens to that investigation.
Sure. I think the things to watch are, one, to see as more information comes out about what events happened in the lead up to the firing. And it all, we've seen some things dribble out, and I would expect that we'll see more in the coming weeks. Comey, you know, there's a possibility of him testifying on Capitol Hill. That'll be one to watch. You know, and ultimately, I think what we'll be watching is, what do congressional Republicans feel like they need to see in terms of a replacement for James Comey, or even potentially a special prosecutor in the Russian hacking investigation. So those are really, I think, some of the things to watch in the coming weeks.
All right. And Jason, while we're with you here, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Madison. It's kind of a busy time again. This morning, you guys had a story about the Republicans in the Senate and their plan for the roads. Assembly Republicans have their own plan. Scott Walker doesn't seem to like either plan. Give us the latest on how the highways and roads issue is shaping up.
Well, there is a pretty big impasse that's holding up the state budget right now. You saw the Assembly Republicans put forward a very sweeping plan. So a plan that would not just ultimately raise taxes on fuel by putting the sales tax on gasoline and then backing down the existing gasoline tax a little bit, but then also raise billions of dollars, make billions of dollars of cuts in the state income tax. And that plan really seems to have fallen pretty flat with both the governor and with Senate Republicans. And where it seems like we're headed is some kind of situation in which money from the state's main account that is used to pay for schools and healthcare, that somehow that money, I think, is probably likely to get taken, at least in part, to shore up the state's transportation fund, you know, which has a real long-term shortfall in it. But the Assembly Republicans really don't want to do that. They want to get a more sustainable approach within the road fund. And so there's going to be a lot of back and forth in the coming weeks about that. Even today, Republicans were talking about the idea of splitting transportation out of the main budget and doing it as a separate bill, which would be pretty unusual, not unprecedented, but certainly unusual.
Yeah, Mary, you spent many years covering the legislature in Madison. So here we have a situation where it seems like everybody agrees we need to do more with roads and that we shouldn't do more with taxes. Why can't they come to an agreement if everyone wants the same sort of thing?
It's interesting because obviously in 2011 when Governor Walker took office and the Senate and Assembly flipped, the Republicans controlled everything, but they were really, with the two Fitzgerald brothers in charge, they were really pretty much in lockstep on a lot of issues, obviously Act 10, other things. And now I think we're really seeing increased divisions, increased fracturing where it's like they're all the same party, but they're all just kind of not at all on the same page. So I think this is kind of a sign that they're diverging and heading in down different paths, and we'll just have to see how they can work it out. But pulling it out of the budget shows me that they are really not close to a resolution, which I think Jason's recent articles have proven.
Yeah, I mean, Jason, let's talk about, just put in isolation the tax proposals then on tax cuts and things. There was some scoring the other day by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau on the Assembly plan, which was saying that, you know, most of the cuts there would go to the wealthier individuals. Is there more agreement on taxes and the cuts and things thereafter, or is that just as elusive as the transportation funding?
Right. Well, I do think the governor and Senate Republicans have been closer on most of these issues, nearly all of these issues. You know, the governor, it's worth remembering, the governor has a number of significant tax cuts in his budget proposal. The governor, and like most of the tax cuts that he's put forward, they have an element that is across the board. So they certainly would deliver a significant amount of tax savings to people at the upper end of the income level, who, you know, typically pay the most in taxes. But there's also an element where, you know, lower and middle class families would also see some tax cuts. And under the Assembly plan, there really is a more predominant tax cut being given to upper income earners. And to a certain extent, you know, some of the provisions within the Assembly tax plan, like raising taxes on fuel and eliminating certain tax credits like the married couple tax credit, would actually have an impact where you would have a significant number, a minority, but a significant minority of taxpayers that would actually be paying more in taxes than they did before. And, you know, Walker has signaled that that's unlikely to earn his support.
Yeah, so, Marion, from your years and past coverage of the budget, I mean, we're still only in early May. Are they reaching a problem point, or they still have plenty of time, don't they, to get their act together and get this resolved?
I think they've still got time. That said, they're going to have to try to work things out pretty quickly because typically, you know, they don't want to be down to the wire heading towards July 1st and scrambling to get stuff done. So I think, you know, it's a little unusual to see this much debate amongst fellow Republicans, but I don't think that they're going to, like, necessarily miss their budget deadline because of it.
All right. And before we move on off of state government, Jason, I want to ask you a little bit about this is some local fallout from the so-called Trump Care debate in Washington, the replacement for Obamacare. And there was this provision that Scott Walker initially said, yeah, I'd be open to it on pre-existing conditions and then quickly back down. Can you give our viewers a quick summation of where that issue stands? Because I know it's of concern to a lot of people.
Yeah, and this will give me a little bit of a chance to preview my winner of the week. But I think, you know, really on Friday, an unexpected winner, and it's certainly by no means decided, but was people with pre-existing conditions. You know, there was some talk, and there still will be talk, of reducing protections in current law for people with pre-existing conditions as they go out to buy health insurance. The governor seemed to, on Friday morning, show some openness to undoing that at the state level if Congress gives us the power to do that. But, you know, one thing that we were struck by when we put up that story was what a big reaction it got for something that is, you know, it's a pretty technical issue within the healthcare system, but it's also something that really can speak very powerful to people who are in that position where they have, you know, a heart condition or they have diabetes or something like that. And within, you know, hours, Walker came back and said, look, that's not what I meant. I was, you know, my remarks were taken out of context, and backpedaled pretty quickly, you know, from that position that he had seemed to take earlier in the day.
All right, well, we're going to shift gears now and go to some other stories we've been running this week with a segment looking at the Bradley Foundation and what some hacked documents have shown in terms of insights we now have on how they're operating. We're joined now by Dan Bice to talk about some very interesting stories he's had in the paper this week about the Bradley Foundation, which, while it's very well known locally, isn't so much well known nationally, but that could be changing, Dan, because as your story has noted, they're in the midst of a very aggressive, expansive effort to take their Wisconsin model and drop it into swing states and important states across the country. Tell us a little bit about that effort.
Well, the Bradley Foundation, as you said, does nationally fly beneath the radar, but has been very influential. They have about $900 million that they can spend. Usually spend about $40, $45 million a year. And in recent years, starting around 2010, they've been doing a lot of stuff nationally, and they decided to change their focus and try to see if they could have some influence in Wisconsin. They set up, or didn't set up, but they funded about 14 nonprofits, very aggressive conservative nonprofits, and they did their work. There was a legal center, their think tanks, their opposition research centers, and they pumped $13 million into those groups, and they were very successful in helping Scott Walker achieve his goals. And coming off of that, they decided, well, let's try this elsewhere. So they've moved into other states. They moved into the state of Washington. Colorado is their big focus right now, and North Carolina.
All right, and let's talk about where these documents came from, because that's its own interesting story. They were hacked
yeah.
by a group from potentially, apparently,
well, they call themselves, the hackers call themselves Anonymous Poland, and right before the election last year, they hacked the records, put stuff out. They inserted three bogus documents in there trying to make it look like the Bradley Foundation was trying to give money to Hillary Clinton, which is funny in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But these same hackers have been involved in other stuff that would be of interest to the Russians, and so cybersecurity experts say it's most likely Russians, though the Bradley Foundation has said that they've spent a lot of money on trying to figure out who it is, and they right now just don't know. So they were hacked. It was out, and it was online for like 5 days, and then they pulled it down, and somebody was able to grab that material at that time, give it to us, and we had to be very careful with it because the information's loaded with viruses and malware and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so, I think it's important to note that the Bradley Foundation officials, these are authentic documents.
They're not disputed.
What we're reporting on, there's no dispute about whether they're accurate. It's just a question of
no, there's no dispute. As soon as you look beyond those three documents, it's immediately clear because everything matches up. The Bradley Foundation has been good about publishing who gets their grants. And what we see in there, there's personnel information in there, but we haven't really focused on that. We've been looking at who gets the grants and why. And you can tell from the records, that sort of stuff. Plus, probably the document that's gotten the most attention so far is their enemies list. The board said, draft a list of people who are thwarting conservatives, and so they came up with 17 names. And they would be the 17 names that you would probably expect if you were drafting mm-hmm. that. So there's the people writing the documents are staffers there. It all fits together. And actually, I was expecting a little bit of pushback from that from them mm-hmm. on the stuff, but they were like,
Well, it's interesting when you get this kind of views, you get this unguarded, unvarnished
you know, authentic, what they're really thinking, not what they're putting out there.
Right. I mean, just an example of that is the discussion about why the Bradley Foundation funded this news operation in Madison, and they said that they were, quote, exploiting the gap in local news due to cutbacks at newspapers, which, I mean, it is true newspapers have cut back and stuff, but I'm sure they wouldn't say publicly we're exploiting this gap or whatever, but it's conservatives talking to conservatives internally about which groups they should spend their money on. But, you know, in addition to that, in addition to the political stuff, the Bradley Foundation is very, very involved locally in the arts community.
Right, and this is that same vein of all these sorts of things that were going on behind the scenes with the symphony and all these different groups that people are
with the symphony. They end up, they gave $15 million to the symphony, the second largest grant they've ever given, but they've never announced that. And the symphony is moving from its current headquarters over to a new location, and it's being underwritten in large part with this donation. They were planning to announce this later on once the symphony had received a certain amount of matching grants, but we were able to see that. We were also able to see with the art museum, there was a portrait called Eggs Benedict of the Pope that was made out of condoms. The people at the Bradley Foundation, a group of very conservative people, did not like this. They went over there, encouraged them to take it down. The art museum refused, so the Bradley Foundation withdrew its grant to the art museum. So we all knew that publicly there was this huge dispute, but we didn't know anything about that. And then another one that we, again, knew nothing about is the public museum has a new director there, and internally at the Bradley Foundation, they had some questions about his political leanings and basically said, we need to keep an eye on this guy. They didn't say why exactly. My guess is there were some concerns about global warming. They say that they had some concerns about the way he was planning to run the operation. But right now they haven't withdrawn funding. In fact, they've been giving a substantial amount of money. So, but you can see their questions. And in addition to that, it's like a keyhole where you can look in on a lot of the arts communities in the grants, because they evaluate these arts groups on how well they're doing financially when they decide whether to spend the money. They'll say, this one's not doing so well, and this one is doing well, and we decided to direct the money that way.
All right. Well, that's some very interesting stories we've had already. There are going to be more stories in the pipeline. You can find all of those at jsonline.com/Bradley. And thanks for joining us to talk about those, Dan.
Sure.
All right, before we turn to some of the local issues, Mary and Jason, I'm just going to quick ask each of you in very few words, what struck you the most out of the Bradley Foundation documents that we've seen so far?
I would say their level of organization, the amount of money that they have, and their enemies list was pretty interesting, too. I think we should create an enemies list as well.
Jason, you may be on our list if you go too long, so tell us what was the most interesting to you out of the package.
Well, I just see them as the Rodney Dangerfield of political foundations, that they don't get any respect. They have nearly $1 billion and have this national impact, and you only hear about other foundations like the Koch Family Foundation. You never hear about the Bradleys in spite of their enormous influence.
Okay, so should we put them on the list or off the list?
I think you did okay.
You did all right. Jason, you're okay for this week. Okay, let's talk about some of our local issues. Mm-hmm. Mary, you've been covering at City Hall several big stories there. One was the Dontra Hamilton settlement. Do you see any reason that wouldn't pass the council and the mayor's signature?
It's tentative. So tentative $2.3 million settlement in the death of Dontra Hamilton. I would be surprised. The city has had a bad track record when things get drawn out in appeals and appeals of losing even more money. And I think that they're looking at stopping the bleeding in some of these lawsuits that they've had where it's just gone on and on. And so I think that I'd be surprised. I mean, maybe they'll try to continue negotiating, but I'd be very surprised if
all right. And speaking of lawsuits that have drawn on and on and on, this other one sort of is getting resolved because they've now approved a liquor license for a strip club in downtown Milwaukee.
Right. And so this has been going on, again, for years and years. The city has lost. They already had a $1 million settlement that they approved with Silk Exotic, or nearly $1 million. They've had more lawsuits filed, and there are projections that they could lose somewhere between upwards of $20 million in additional lawsuits filed over this. Basically, it's considered like a First Amendment free speech limitation. Mm-hmm. So they approved the club, which will be down the road on Old World 3rd Street if everything goes according to plan. And it's kind of an interesting conglomeration of basically strip club owners who have tried to apply in the past and been rejected and sued have now come together to try to open this club called Executive Lounge is the plan.
All right. Well, let's go now to our winners and losers. And Mary, I'm going to start with you, and knowing your winner, it's going to be right where you finish. So who's the winner of the week?
So I'm going to say strip club owners. They have been fighting for this for a very long time. They really see with the growing downtown a opportunity to make a lot more money. They have a Silk Exotic out on Silver Spring, but they really wanted to be downtown and wanted to be within walking distance of convention centers and hotels and other downtown entertainment, and they finally got their wish, assuming this all.
And Jason,
they could get sued, I suppose, but we'll see.
All right, Jason, you kind of gave away the suspense earlier, but give us your winner from the past week.
Right. So, again, I think at least for now, people in Wisconsin with pre-existing conditions, certainly they won one battle of a larger war on Friday, getting the governor to back off.
All right. And Jason, your loser of the week.
Well, you know, I have to say the Assembly Republicans for putting forward, I mean, sweeping transportation plan, big policy, thinking big, thinking outside the box. But again, I don't think they're going to get out of that box ultimately because, Governor Walker and Senate Republicans are just not willing to go there.
All right. And Mary, you're a loser of the week.
I'm going to go with Mr. Comey, who we talked about before. He could end up a winner, obviously, if he does this knock it out of the park testimony about his investigation into Russia, or if he gets a good book deal out of this. But he's obviously been heavily criticized lately, was fired, and shortly before he was fired, he was really widely panned for his testimony about, especially about Clinton's longtime aide, saying she had forwarded tens of thousands of emails to her troubled husband, which does not seem to be true.
All right, so we've got a couple minutes left here to go to some viewer questions, and Jason, I'm going to throw the first one to you. This is from Just Saying, who asks, what will it take for Republicans to start acknowledging a special prosecutor is needed? Didn't we get one for a lot less with Bill Clinton? What do you think it's going to take? I mean, there's all this, the Democrats are calling for one, but what would it take for, say, a Paul Ryan or Ron Johnson or someone like that to call for a special prosecutor?
Well, I think it's going to take a lot. You saw Mitch McConnell say that, you know, pretty much put that off the table immediately earlier this week. But, you know, I think it always comes down to how much heat is the party that controls the presidency feeling in Congress for them to put, you know, additional scrutiny on an administration. And I did see today Mike Lee, a senator from Utah, had put forward the idea of naming Merrick Garland. So this is the Supreme Court nominee that failed to be confirmed, to put him as the FBI director because he's a former prosecutor. And, you know, that to me at least said that they were feeling some heat about the special prosecutor or otherwise. Why put forward that somewhat surprising name, at least from a Republican?
All right. And Mary, let me throw one to you. This is from Frank on Second Shift, who should be off of work by now, I think. I'll try to summarize it. The gist of it is, he says, does everybody think that the firing is going to stop the entire investigation? So he has some other more details. Sort of, do you think this still moves forward? Doesn't it? Is this a sidelight that the real thing, somebody's going to be looking at the files and continuing this, right?
Obviously, Comey's not the only one who's been participating in the investigation. He's not the only one who knows what's in the file. That said, you know, if somebody who was just doing this investigation gets fired after talking about it and after asking for more resources, I guess it raises questions of who will take his place, and will it be somebody who is maybe less likely to pursue it or who thinks, if I'm too aggressive in this, I could lose my job too. So I do think that there can be a chilling effect when somebody leading an investigation is fired. But I don't think this is the last we've heard of the investigation.
All right, that's where we're going to end it this week. And we're going to end it right on time. So Jason, you stay off of our enemy list for this week. We'll put you on, you know, potentially in the future. We'll see. But we thank our audience for joining us. Thanks to Mary and Jason for joining us as well. And we'll see you at the same time next week.